tune the radio thing. I've been doing it for a while, I guess maybe more than 25 years, though it used to have the name Info Saturday, which when I got to be able to change the name, I did quickly because, yeah, it's Saturday, and this is Info. Okay. Neptune comes from the idea that in the documentary called Manufacturing Consent about Noam Chomsky, he is said by the guy that was booking people for Nightline at the time, interviewed at WORT, that he couldn't be on Nightline because his views are from Neptune. So that's...
Neptune?
Well, it's a metaphor, right? Which is now the outermost planet, though now they've got Planet 10 or Planet X or something that is looming out beyond our ken, way out there. So if it sounds way out there, it's only because the mainstream media doesn't talk about it, because they're the corporate media. They really aren't the mainstream, as is maybe being demonstrated in some ways. What I do is generally kick it off with Breaking the Sound Barrier by Amy Goodman, and there's a good one on Flint, Michigan, which was discussed in the previous hour. Let's see whether she talks about the possible role of ALEC in the whole privatization scam that was the basis for the immiseration of the budgets of cities so they could be taken over then. The backstory, I keep repeating it, but I'm still not hearing it many places, is that state-level takeover of the municipalities was overturned by popular referendum, and then they passed it as a appropriations bill, so it put it beyond the reach of popular recall, as it were. And it's really a big corporate scam to take over, get rid of the niceties of democracy, and take over water systems, and et cetera, et cetera. So that's my spin on it, and you don't hear it anywhere. Okay, Glenn Ford's going to be the first part, as usual. Just one up at the new, one commentary up at Black Agenda Reports that I could find. And I've got a little outtake from the Friday Forum series that's coming up, which is all about breaking down racism. And it's the woman that was scheduled last year, in from Rutgers, talking about Say Her Name, hashtag Say Her Name. If she didn't start it on Twitter, she's one of the people that tweets a lot there. And it was a pretty engaging talk. And the entirety will be on 6 o'clock, but just to promote it a little bit and have a little taste of what it's like, I've got a section where she's talking about the Trayvon Martin case. Apparently, yesterday was Trayvon Martin's birthday. He would have reached legal majority, I think, right? Perhaps, I'm not sure. So that's coming up. Some economic issues, you might think. Naomi Prinz, who was with Flashpoints this week, she's got a new book called All the President's Bankers. She starts out with the Jekyll Island meeting, where the Federal Reserve was cabaled, and she brings it down to the present day. Obviously not up to the minute, since the allegations about Goldman Sachs and what was said or what was not said. Got a call, and maybe that's for... Naomi Prinz was actually, and Dennis didn't do this, she was actually on a Bernie Sanders advisory committee to reform the Federal Reserve. So she comes at it with a affiliation, at least by, she was selected by Bernie Sanders to help with analyzing what could be done to make the Federal Reserve less of a rich man's club, taking the punch away when the party gets started, as the metaphor goes, if you've heard that one. Anyway, here is Glenn Ford from the Black Agenda Reports.
Advocates of reparations and black community control of the police got a boost from a panel of the United Nations last week. The UN's working group of experts on people of African descent heard testimony in 5 cities on violations of black Americans' human rights. The experts will issue a full report to the United Nations Human Rights Council in September, but their preliminary statement paints a picture of endemic racial oppression in criminal justice, education, housing, employment, health care, virtually every aspect of life in the USA. Of course, the United Nations is not going to force the U.S. to pay reparations to its black citizens or compel America to remove its blue-uniformed army of occupation from black communities. Only black Americans themselves can make that happen. However, the UN's critique of U.S. racial policies and practices is important. Even a corporate-ruled imperialist superpower born in slavery and genocide can be embarrassed when its crimes are revealed on the world stage. President Eisenhower was a segregationist, but he could not act like one when the world was watching the black American struggle against Jim Crow back in the 1950s. In the 60s, Malcolm X urged black people to take their human rights grievances to the United Nations, where the seats in the General Assembly were filling up with delegates from the formerly colonized countries of the world. Under the gaze of global humanity, the United States pretended to welcome the end of official American apartheid. Nowadays, President Obama attempts to convince the world that the U.S. would really like to get rid of mass black incarceration, although he'd have to release 7 out of every 8 prisoners to bring the U.S. incarceration rate down to 1970 levels. Still, when activists go to the UN offices in Geneva, Switzerland, to document the barbarity and racism of the U.S. criminal justice system, Washington is compelled to respond. Half a century ago, black Americans earned the respect and admiration of struggling peoples all over the world because we were perceived as waging a heroic fight for justice and human rights here in the belly of the beast. And although the Black Panther Party has been defunct in the U.S. for 2 generations, people in places like India and even New Zealand still proudly call themselves Black Panthers. However, the Black American reputation has suffered over the years. The world has seen us represented by the likes of Colin Powell and Condoleezza Rice, and now the mad bomber in the White House and his genocidal national security advisor, Susan Rice, the individual most closely identified with the slaughter of 6 million Congolese. With all of these black American war criminals and fiends strutting around the global stage, the African American reputation in the world has been in dire need of rehabilitation. But then Ferguson intervened, and black America seemed like it might have rediscovered its soul. Black folks are actually making demands of power, and the United Nations is paying attention. There is hope for us yet. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford. On the web, go to blackagendareport.com.
You'll find some amazing things there, as we did last week as well. Again, Amy Goodman. Oh, I didn't run down the entire... Now, I mentioned Naomi Prinz at some length, because I had to do that sort of... declaim her affiliation, I guess. Greg Palast, well, he used to be with Al Jazeera America before they folded. He's with the BBC sometimes. He's a stringer. He gets on Democracy Now! Sometimes. He was with, also, we're doing flashpoints today in the bulk of the show. He was on the beginning of the week, so there's a little dated stuff there, but there's some stuff reprising his whole analysis of the election and the current cross-check problem that looms pretty large, he thinks, pretty comparable to in voter disqualification of African-Americans and maybe Arab-Americans and maybe Latino-Americans. Stephen Zunes, and I probably won't get all of this on, was quick to go to Facebook after the first of the town halls or debates about what Hillary Clinton said about her votes for the the war, Bush's war, it's called, but obviously Senator Kerry and Senator, Clinton voted for it. He says that she misrepresents what she was doing. She claimed some support for Hans Blix's point of view, but and also didn't vote for the Senator Levin, Michigander senator who wanted to tie any action to a certification by the IEA that the inspectors were not being effective. So she didn't vote for that. So and implied otherwise. All right. Well, so more on that later. It's obviously a contentious issue, and well, I don't know. The way the polls are going, maybe it isn't that contentious. But here's Amy Goodman about Flint.
The terror of Flint's poisoned water. I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! With Dennis Moynihan and our weekly Breaking the Sound Barrier podcast. Less than a month after the attacks of September 11th, a senior FBI official, Ronald Dick, told the House Committee on Transportation and Infrastructure, due to the vital importance of water to all life forms, the FBI considers all threats to attack the water supply as serious threats, unquote. In 2003, a UPI article reported that an al-Qaeda operative, quote, does not rule out using sarin gas and poisoning drinking water in U.S. and Western cities, unquote. Where the terrorists have failed to mount any attack on a water supply, the Michigan state government has succeeded. In the city of Flint, lead-poisoned water has been piped into homes and offices since 2014, causing widespread illness and potentially permanent brain damage among its youngest residents. Michigan has one of the most severe emergency manager laws in the country, allowing the governor to appoint an unelected agent to take over local governments when those locales or institutions have been deemed to be in a financial emergency. Republican Governor Rick Snyder pushed for and obtained two bills that strengthen the law and has used it aggressively to impose his version of fiscal austerity on cities like Detroit, Benton Harbor, several large school districts, and now, most notoriously, on Flint. In every case but one, the emergency manager has taken over cities that are majority African American. The emergency manager is granted sweeping powers to override local democratically elected governments and to make cuts to budgets, sell public property, cancel or renegotiate labor contracts, and essentially govern like a dictator. In April 2014, Darnell Early, the fourth of five Flint emergency managers appointed by Governor Snyder, unilaterally decided to switch Flint's water source from Detroit's water system with water from Lake Huron that they'd been using for 50 years to the long, contaminated, and corrosive Flint River. Flint residents immediately noticed discoloration and bad smells from the water and experienced an array of health impacts, like rashes and hair loss. In October 2014, General Motors decided it would no longer use Flint City water in its plants as it was corroding metal car parts. Later, trihalomethanes, a toxic byproduct of water treatment, were found in the water. Despite that, the water was declared safe by officials. At the same time, as revealed in an email later obtained by Progress Michigan, the state began shipping coolers of clean, potable water to the state office building in Flint. This was more than a year before Governor Snyder would admit that the water was contaminated. Ongoing activism by Flint residents whose children were sick attracted the involvement of water researchers from Virginia Tech, who found that 10,000 residents had been exposed to elevated lead levels. It took out-of-state researchers from Virginia to travel all the way to Michigan to conduct the comprehensive tests needed. Dr. Mona Hanna-Attisha then got involved. She's the director of the pediatric residency program at Hurley Children's Hospital and assistant professor of pediatrics at Michigan State University. She discovered an alarming connection between rising blood levels in Flint's children with the switch to the Flint River as a water source.
The percentage of children with elevated lead levels doubled in the whole city, and in some neighborhoods it tripled, and it directly correlated with where the water lead levels were the highest.
She told us on the Democracy Now! NewsHour. Rather than going after the problem she identified, the state went after her.
We were attacked. So I was called an unfortunate researcher, that I was causing near hysteria, that I was splicing and dicing numbers, and that the state data was not consistent with my data. And as a scientist, as a researcher, as a professional, you double check and you triple check, and the numbers didn't lie. So, and we knew that. But when the state, with a team of like 50 epidemiologists tells you you're wrong, you second guess yourself.
Within weeks, state authorities were forced to admit that Dr. Mona Hanna Attisha was right. Soon after, she was standing at the governor's side and has just been appointed to run a new public health initiative to help those exposed to the contamination. A chorus of Flint residents and allies are demanding immediate action to ensure safe, clean water to the people of Flint. Many are calling for Governor Snyder to resign or even to be arrested. The FBI and the Justice Department are now investigating to see if any laws were broken. This week, the House held a hearing on the crisis, during which Houston Congressmember Sheila Jackson Lee compared the poisoning of Flint residents to the 1978 mass suicide and murder in Jonestown, Guyana.
As I sit here today, the memories of a Jim Jones who gave a poison concoction to children causes me to say that there is a Jim Jones in Michigan who gave a poison concoction to children and their families.
In Guyana, cult leader Jim Jones ordered his 900 followers, 300 of them children, to drink cyanide-laced Kool-Aid. Those victims died instantly. In Flint, the tragedy will unfold over decades. I'm Amy Goodman with Dennis Moynihan.
Pretty potent, but still missing this business about the backstory. I've tweeted it a couple of times, Democracy Now! I don't know what I need to do. Keep talking about it, I guess. The fact that this takeover law was rejected by this popular vote in Michigan and then was reinstated through a loophole by calling it a appropriations bill. Well, we got shenanigans here. There's the hostage taking that's still going on. Those are actually apparently ex-governor. What am I doing from Charleston, right? Fair-haired, Ian, the only one that hasn't been indicted, and maybe he should have been for management services. Well, what a brain fade that is! I should have written that letter. Then I would have it in front of me. But Edgar, yeah, of course. Governor Jim Edgar called this hostage taking and said that he should back away from the turnaround agenda. But the Democrats actually have a supermajority. But I understand that this Duncan guy that missed one of the critical votes on the union issue a while back has just gotten $500,000 from some questionable sources, not the usual Democratic funders. He's in the African American community in the West Side, if I recall. So hopefully that will seal his fate and somebody will run against him. Amy Goodman, again, getting a lot of things. Well, there's a lot of criticism all the time, and I have my critiques, particularly about Jeju Island. And some people were annoyed that she had this woman from the Working People's Party, which is a fusion party out in New York. They have a different system where you can have joint parties. So it's it's a coalition building mechanism for having smaller parties. And it would be neat to investigate it, but anyway, so she's on, usually they align with the Democrats, and she was a Hillary supporter, and all these people, I noticed at least one that said he just turned off when she was announced, but they had Li Fang on, who was the intrepid young journalist from The Intercept, who actually asked the question of Hillary, and it then spread widely, are you going to release the text of your Goldman Sachs speeches that you got $625,000 for in a series of three speeches? I guess maybe she's going to claim they're now Goldman Sachs property and she can't release them or something. There's a rumor that she actually did say something like doesn't share this anti-bank populism that's rampant in the country, and well, it should be. On a issue of the war, which we may get to with Stephen Zunes later than Sauer, but if not, I'll get to it tomorrow at 5 o'clock, or you can find it at Flashpoints on SoundCloud or He's got a piece up somewhere, too, so look for Stephen Zunes. He was met him here on campus. He was a scholar in residence over at Allen Hall at Unit 1 some time ago. But Li Fang, as well as having this good stuff, what a name, was asked to comment, and this has been going around, too, accepting the praise from Henry Kissinger for her running of the State Department. And Li Fang's comment is, nothing says anti-establishment like praising Henry Kissinger on stage and accepting his praise, I guess, is what he's also saying. All right, well, not bashing, just want to get the details out. It's a little intimidating. I'm feeling a little intimidated. All right, here's a section where I'm going to actually play a couple of excerpts from recent Friday Forums. The series is broadcast the following Monday at 6 o'clock. I'll be working on that. There's still some kind of anomalous audio problem, even though the soldering has been done over at the Y. Apparently that was the problem. There was actually a hardwire flaw in this new system that they have over there. I'm going to play the section I foreshadowed earlier about this Rachel Jontel. And I actually, there was something about her was the question that I formulated. But this was in the first part of her talk. But let's get to Tamar first, and I'll name her on the way out since somebody's taken down the... Oh, no, they are. The first speaker was Tamar Manasseh, Mothers Against Senseless Killings, taking some credit for quelling violence and murder rate in Chicago, in Inglewood. But here's my question, or my statement, which she reacts to in a on the ground and insightful way, it seems to me, bringing her analysis from the street, as it were.
You mentioned the lack of funding for schools, but I wonder if you have any anecdotes or any detail about the disruption that the turnaround school charterization, closing of all the schools, which just didn't start under Rahm, it started under Arne Duncan. I just wonder if you know.
And it's been a downward spiral ever since.
But it disrupted neighborhoods in horrible ways.
And it's gotten a lot of kids killed.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, we see a lot of that. And actually, this year we'll be pretty much organizing in the community to keep a school from being closed down in one area of Inglewood because the kids would have to be sent to another school and it's rival gangs and it's a lot of different gang territories they would have to pass through. And the kids in the two schools are different gangs and we can't have that happen. And until we can eradicate gangs, we can't keep putting these kids in the same places together.
Casual disruption of neighborhoods by theoreticians of corporate turnaround. That's the model that Arne Duncan introduced being continued, and the metaphor continues with our governor. So, all right. And then more recently, as of just yesterday, they rescheduled Dr. Brittany Cooper towards gender-inclusive movement for racial justice, hashtag say her name. I think that you can find that by putting it in on Facebook, too, but if you don't do that Twitter thing. They claim they're going to go to more characters on Twitter, so it'll be daunting to have to fill up 1,000 characters instead of whatever it is now. But if you don't have to. But anyway, Facebook was also announcing that they were going to have more options than just liking, too, but they haven't instituted it yet. But I meander, and setting this up is a little complicated. Again, at the top of the hour, I mentioned she was sort of riffing on the fact that it was Trayvon Martin's birthday, if he had lived. And I don't know exactly how old he would have been. But the friend that was on the phone with him, Rachel Jontel, spoke at the trial and was widely derided, and apparently she's the butt of bullying at the school, and Trayvon was one of the people that didn't do that. She had a mild speech impediment. I brought up the fact that she was also of Haitian origin and had a bit of a lilt in her language as well. But Brittany Cooper used this as a sort of a way to approach internalization of white supremacy by African Americans, and some very nuanced things that are definitely well worth a good listen, and I commend it to your attention in its entirety on Monday at 6. But here's a little excerpt just to pitch it a little bit and bring some of these insights to this show. Again, I've got some segments coming up. Won't get them all on. I got the Zunas up last, and that's the most international of issues. The Bush War, so-called, and their cronies in the Senate of both sides, but mostly economic and electoral issues with Naomi Prinz and Greg Palast in the second half hour here. But here's Brittany Cooper from the Friday Forum. The whole series is called Breaking Down Racism, Fighting Racial Injustice in the U.S. It's kind of the prescriptive part of the series from the semester, though, because Brittany Cooper was unable to make her trip, and I guess she had some hard traveling from New Jersey. Rutgers is where she hangs her hat. Not yet tenured either, but claims she was asked about academics in the radicals in the academia as the last question. So probably won't get that on, but all of it will be available through the UPTV at some point. And perhaps other methods too. There was an attempt to live stream it, so there actually might be an already available document, and I know for sure that the UPTV does not have all of the Q&A, including the one about radicals in academia.
Mainstream ridicule of her forthright, pull-no-punches demeanor, her physical appearance, and her style of speaking, coupled with the eventual acquittal of Zimmerman, suggests that on strictly legal grounds, her testimony failed. Dark-skinned, plus-sized, and reluctant to be in the courtroom, Rachel carried the weight of racial representation on her shoulders. She immediately became the object of ridicule and scrutiny in social media, as black folks shamefully lamented her broken English and derisively compared her to the likes of Lee Daniels' Precious and Tyler Perry's Madea. Because the case was so deeply polarized along racial lines, the white vitriol against Rachel and Trayvon came as no surprise. But the black racial disdain toward Rachel betrayed deeply internalized shame around white supremacy and a continued investment in the politics of respectability as a salve to these wounds of ours. By not offering a stellar example of race womanhood, by not being above moral reproach, both of which were characteristics necessary for Rachel to even be believed, she failed the race. Or so the story goes. But there's a different story for us to tell, especially on this day, Trayvon's day. And that story is the one Rachel came to sit upon the witness stand to tell. Hers was a story about a boy named Trayvon, her friend since grade school, her friend who never bullied her, even when so many others did, her friend who lingered in the rain on a February night to talk to her before he went back inside for the game. To him, her size, her speech impediment, and her deep, dark, plum-colored skin did not constitute an indictment of her value or her ideas, did not make her unworthy of being seen, listened to, and heard. And it's really important to think about the kind of tenderness between these two friends and the ways that Trayvon is represented in the media as a thug, but this conversation between the two of them asks us to have a really different narrative, and the ways that black women and girls are asked to be protectors of that narrative and to guard it, even when it is so violently snatched away from us by the state.
Brittany Cooper, and you can hear the entirety of that regularly scheduled rebroadcast of the Friday Forum at 6 o'clock on Mondays, always the following. The next one coming up is a local panel, including someone who sits in this chair, Aaron Ammons, city councilor in Urbana, Evelyn Reynolds, who is a local activist with Black Lives Matters, Parkland instructor for identification purposes only. And Marlon Mitchell, who's an activist in the community, they're going to do a panel on local efforts for racial justice. And then a conversation with Opal Tometi, one of the three women that founded the Black Lives Matter hashtag and part of the movement. And that will not be a broadcast, so I'm probably going to put on Angela Davis in its stead from when she spoke last year at the Y. And they are very sensitive about being taken out of context and excerpted, I suppose, maybe. And it'll also not be at the Y. They're looking for a slightly bigger venue, and it'll be over at Allen Hall. I don't know if she's going to be in residence there, and maybe that's part of the reason as well. But, well, you can find Unit 1 on the UVI website and confirm that. Maybe I'll try and do that before. So, anyway, other issues. Reclaiming our narrative, Million Hoodies movement, police and youth relations, bridging the divide, Eddie Bocanegra. And this is also kind of rescheduled from last year. Local professor James Anderson of Ed Policy, the history of African American school achievement in the 20th century. And he'll be sharing the bill with Dr. Lorenzo Baber, or Baber, I guess it might be. So. And then Teresa Barnes, local activist, Complicity and Reconciliation, a South African by birth, and maybe makes one think of the Reconciliation Committee commissions over there. Makes me think also of reparations, but anyway, I don't want to go on that. Opinions are those of the speakers. We're about halfway through the hour, and I shouldn't have a door open because we got an open door policy down here. I'm going to go right to Naomi Prinz in discussion with Flashpoints. Hey, guys, how you doing? Here we go. Naomi Prinz with Flashpoints. Well, here's the name of the book from Dennis Bernstein, The Horse's Mouth.
Running. Naomi Prinz is the author of most recently an article called Democracy of the Billionaire, subtitled The Most Expensive Election Ever is a Billionaire's Playground, except for Bernie Sanders. Naomi Prinz, welcome to Flashpoints.
Thank you so much.
Well, it's good to have you with us. Could you please paint us a bit of a thorough picture? What does the money look like? Who owns these candidates? Give us a bit of a rundown.
Well, I tried to actually in the piece run this down by categories in terms of owning and therefore perspective of some of the billionaires behind some of these candidates. And, you know, for example, Ted Cruz, who won last night for the Republican side, I consider his billionaire class to be the most God-fearing billionaires. And that is because obviously he has the whole evangelical thing going pretty strong, but also because, he has these packs, super packs called the Keep the Promise packs. They're sort of like an action movie franchise. There's Keep the Promise 1, Keep the Promise 2, Keep the Promise 3, which have amassed so far about, $38 million. And I think that number is going to go up quite substantially. But the interesting thing is that it's in chunks, and the chunks are put up by different billionaires. So there's a $15 million chunk from a group of Texas fracking billionaires, evangelical fracking billionaires, the Wilkes brothers. If there's $10 million from another billionaire who serves the purposes of the Christian community and so forth. So that's sort of one class of billionaires. And again, I think that's going to be expanding, particularly with his win in Iowa.
And his wife is well placed at Goldman Sachs as well.
Yes, I should mention this. Now, Goldman Sachs, so far, besides having given him the loan for his last campaign, which he forgot to sort of mention on his filings at the time, yes, his wife did work for Goldman. And so far, on a corporate donor basis, Goldman Sachs, the total of its individual contributions now, so outside of the super PAC community, has been a measly $44,000. But that's now individual contributions. That number will go up. So he's basically third place in terms of Republicans the Goldman Sachs individuals are supporting. Again, I think that's going to change. Jeb Bush was actually in first place, but by a mile. But of course, he's not really in the running anymore.
Yeah, so to speak,
so
yeah.
Cruz will definitely get the benefit of a lot of that. And Rubio is also well-placed, actually, with Goldman Sachs. So beyond Jeb, Marco Rubio actually has the most Goldman Sachs does lead his pack of corporate donors with $80,000. And again, that's different from his super PAC contributors. So there's lots of different money coming in from individuals within corporations as well as these super PACs. And again, in terms of other breakdowns, the billionaires, Rubio has a lot of hedge fund billionaires. That's largely because he's going to let them keep a lot of the tax breaks that they have, and his tax plans enable them to sort of amass more money offshore. I'm summarizing. Then we have, of course, the billionaires behind Hillary Clinton, as well as the corporations behind Hillary Clinton, as well as the places from which she raises money on Wall Street and in different financial sectors there, including her own money that she has also pledged into the campaign, which has also come from a large amassing of the Clinton family money over the years, as well as speeches that were given both by Bill Clinton while she was Secretary of State, and also by herself after she was Secretary of State, for which, for example, she made about $3 million simply in 12 speeches to the Wall Street community in the last 2 years. So again, money's coming in from everywhere, and so whether there's a major billionaire distinction or it's a sector that makes billions, it has definitely an impact on these candidates, and it's going to get much more, much larger as this campaign goes forward. We're already speculating $2.5-3 billion worth of money coming in, which makes it the most expensive election. But a lot of it, with the exception of Bernie Sanders and one could say Donald Trump, because he actually is his own billionaire, has been coming from the top, and the portion of individual contributions to different candidates and small, particularly individual contributions, has been skewed low with most of the candidates. Again, the exception is Bernie Sanders, who has a 77-78% small individual contribution percentage of all of his donations, has no super PACs and has no billionaires, and none of the Wall Street companies are in his top corporate donor list.
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're speaking with Naomi Prince. Her one of her books is All the President's Bankers, has been following the money, the massive amount of money that's going into this election, and really has been tracking the nature of money as it relates to presidents and who controls these major politicians. You have said earlier that of the five Democrats candidates, only Senator Sanders now, well, O'Malley's gone now, but Senator Sanders, Governor O'Malley are pressing for the resurrection of the Glass-Steagall Act. Now, that was gutted by Bill Clinton. Why is that important? I imagine that's the kind of threat that these billionaires want to squash. Let's not have Glass-Steagall. You want to talk a little bit about that?
Sure, and it does break into the fact that both for Hillary Clinton on the Democrat side and for a number of the candidates on the GOP side, including Jeb when he had a candidacy, and Marco Rubio and Ted Cruz in particular, who've been receiving money from Goldman and other banks, that Glass-Steagall is something that all of these institutions would rather not see resurrected. Yes, the Glass-Steagall Act was repealed under Bill Clinton's administration in November of 1999, and during that time, Senator Sanders actually voted against the repeal of that act. And what's happened in the year since is we've had a mini crisis in the Enron and WorldCom scandals in the beginning of the 2000s, which we tend to sort of forget was a part of taking Glass-Steagall apart and allowing banks to finance all sorts of bad energy and telecom sector derivatives. But more recently, of course, we've had the subprime crisis, and the fact that we did not have a Glass-Steagall separation of people's mortgage loans and deposits relative to what banks could create from those securities they could create from those mortgages, and putting them into new kinds of packages that they could then slice and dice and sell throughout the world, that could not exist. That very action of taking from one side loans and creating new securities from them and trading them could not have happened if Glass-Steagall had still existed. And because it has been repealed was one of the big reasons that we had such a meltdown in the financial crisis and we have the most epic bailout of banks in general. So none of the candidates, and yes, O'Malley had been when he was a candidate, and of course Bernie Sanders aside, have wanted to even talk about resurrecting that Glass-Steagall law. Hillary Clinton has said that her plan is stronger than Glass-Steagall, and the only people who believe that are the people who, you know, are basically coming from these banks, being funded by these banks, speaking to these banks, and so they don't really count because her plan is not stronger than Glass-Steagall. She simply ignores how the commercial banks and investment banks that can take loans and create securities from them actually operate in the financial system and has been trying to act as if and speak as if somehow Glass-Steagall would not have kept them from their association and their role in the financial crisis and the subprime crisis, which is just simply not true if you follow any of the money or any of how banks create securities.
Well, now, Hillary Clinton is famous for saying that, look, she was the senator from New York. She had to, you know, deal with Wall Street. She knows how to deal with Wall Street. She does, doesn't she?
Well, she made $3 million out of Wall Street. And if you think about it, if you make $3 million from Wall Street in just 2 years, or 2.5 years, let's say, that's not bad.
That's pretty good.
$1 million a year. People would be happy. And most people, many people, I'm assuming, who listen to the show would be very happy to make that kind of money from Wall Street. And the thing, though, about it is that if you're associated, because a lot of what happens with this money is it means more than simply the dollars and cents, right? I mean, if you're a billionaire and you kick in $15 million to someone's super PAC, you're not going to feel it. But what a lot of this is it's about relationships. It's about, you know, lining up ideologies, philosophies, you know, the associations between the people that run some of the largest, say, banks or other companies, or the people that are most high in the political system. And it's about their connections. And they reinforce each other. So if Hillary Clinton or anyone is going to be speaking at Goldman Sachs, making that kind of money, and is also in a public office or running for a public office, they're not going to turn around and sort of smack them down in terms of reducing their ability to make profits going forward. They're just simply not going to do that. In my last book, All the President's Bankers, and this was true of both sides of the aisle, I specifically looked at all of the highest ranking individuals in the government through the presidents and in the financial system through the largest banks. And the reality is, no one bites the hand that feeds them, not just from a money standpoint, but also from a relationship standpoint. And those are two things that are, that have to be examined together when we think about how, a candidate is acting with respect to their reception on Wall Street and in the financial community, and vice versa, the access that the most senior people on Wall Street and the financial community have towards a particular public office, whether it's the presidency, whether it's the Treasury Department, whether it's the Federal Reserve.
Yeah, well, you know, I think about the Secretary of Commerce who crashed a bank in Chicago, cost about 1,400 people almost most of their life savings, then went on to be one of the inventors of these kind of securitized loan concoctions that were sold to Wall Street, and then she ends up electing the president. Everybody wondered why Barack Obama could raise more money than the Clinton machine, and here's Penny Pritzker.
Right. And the reality is he did raise more money than the Clinton machine. But we also have to recognize that more money in each election is being raised from the Wall Street community, from the corporate community. And now, after the 2010 Citizens United Act, a decree from also the billionaire and millionaire community. So all of the elections have gone exponentially bigger in terms of the just sheer total amount of donations, and also the skew, that the percentage of money that comes from the richer side versus individual contributions. So for example, super PACs relative to individual contributions, which are maxed out at $2,700, have about a 5.5-to-1 ratio. So the money that is created and used in elections, in this particular election, is about more than 5 times the amount that it is coming from the sort of upper class, the 1%, the billionaires, the super PAC money relative to just regular people who want to support their candidate at the lower levels of contribution. So again, this is systemic now. And Obama was, going back to, you know, your point, was supported by Goldman. It was one of his top contributors, as well as Bill Clinton had been, not least because of also the fact that after Bill Clinton became the president, he appointed as his Treasury Secretary Robert Rubin, who had been the co-CEO of Goldman Sachs, as a thank you for helping him to amass money. And because, as he said, Bill Clinton in his memoirs, because he liked the economic policies of Robert Rubin, which led to, going back to what we were talking about a few minutes ago, the repeal of Glass-Steagall. So it's all very circular.
Well, now enter Michael Bloomberg, and I think he's got more money than a couple of times more money than Donald Trump. Now, tell us about his threat.
I don't really see that happening. I can't imagine. His threat was that if Donald Trump was the Republican candidate and Bernie Sanders was the Democrat candidate, he would sort of save the world and pop in as an independent candidate. I don't see him doing that. First of all, I don't really see Donald Trump being the candidate of the Republican Party. And I also don't see, if that were to happen, Michael Bloomberg going up against him, because, I mean, that would just be way too ridiculous.
Oh, my God. Well, more ridiculous than banning all Muslims from coming into the country, or throwing all Latinos out because they're, I mean, you know, we're going a distance in this one.
Exactly.
I don't know. I tell you, it's incredibly important, the work that you're doing. And, we just have a minute left, but the example that Bernie Sanders is setting is also extraordinary. It's sort of a direct response, right?
Yes. Now, first of all, Bernie Sanders at 77-78% of his contributions have come from those smaller donors. So he really stands in stark contrast to most of the rest, all of the rest of the field, in that he has the highest percentage of individual small donors who have contributed to his campaign. He has no super PACs, he has no billionaires, and none of his top corporate contributors are Wall Street firms. So he's not just talking about a policy out of some will to have people who are more progressive embrace him. No, he actually has lived this policy. And that's why the authenticity of his message is reflected in the numbers, in terms of his campaign contributions and who is making up those contributions. And so I think that's really important. He has had more individual contributions, numerically, like more actual specific individual ones than Barack Obama had, and Barack Obama had a significant amount. So he has increased by a significant percentage of those as well. And I think just from a message standpoint, that's a very meaningful difference relative to the 5-to-1 ratios of super PACs and higher corporate donor money coming into all of the other candidates relative to their smaller individual contributions.
All right. We're going to have to leave it right there. Nomi Prince, I really thank you for taking the time out and talking about this stuff, which is incredibly important if we want to preserve the democracy. I thank you for joining us. Your most recent book, All the President's Bankers, a very worthwhile read. You should check it out. I thank you for joining us on Flashpoints.
Thank you so much.
Naomi Prince, great title. And as I mentioned, somewhere along the line, the book starts with the meeting at Jekyll Island, where the Federal Reserve was inaugurated in the aughts, I guess, sometime in the aughts. Got a call from a colleague, or a text from a colleague, actually, who said, why are you announcing that you're not broadcasting the Friday Farm on the following Monday? I thought I said otherwise. The only thing I did say that could have been misinterpreted is that Opal Tometi, founder of Black Lives Movement, apparently they have a general prohibition of recording and sharing their talks. They feel like they've been screwed by the media. And even though we would run it in its entirety and it wouldn't be out of context, maybe that'll change. Maybe there are people working on this. I don't know. But I don't think so. So I'll be putting something on in lieu of that. Also got a text from a friend, activist, who says, well, the stalwarts are going to be out at the One Main demo. It's the first Saturday of the month. So you can go out there between 2 and 4 or swing by or check them out, see if there's a leaflet this week. I know this colleague of mine is also interested in the Solar Social, and that's at noon. It says free, but registration required. I guess you can go to illinoisolar.org and still get registered. And it's a social, so I guess you don't have to show up for the whole time. I'm thinking about making it over. Though the ISEA board president will update participants on the Illinois Clean Jobs Bill, which I think Carol Ammons is a co-sponsor of, if not an initiator of. Anyway, the Equinox House is at 1103 North High Cross Road. It's a solar high-efficiency home, and the public is welcome to attend, but I guess you have to register at illinoisolar.org, and maybe you just want to go there and see what's happening. All right, I have the one more segment. I guess we'll get to the foreign policy issues, talk about maybe the quadrupling of arms to Europe, stash them forward so that the Europeans can be assured that if U.S. NATO encircle them and provokes an open war, that the war will be fought on their soil. How reassuring is that? Anyway, get my tongue out of my cheek and introduce again from Flashpoints. This is the inestimable Greg Palast, and they start out talking about Arpaio, who apparently is a big Trump booster, so maybe he's depressed also because of his legal problems. But it interconnects with voter suppression and all sorts of great issues, and we'll get as much as this we can on. This was from Monday or Tuesday Flashpoints. You can find the entirety of it up very easily at SoundCloud, and you can download it and all that good stuff as well from SoundCloud.com. Just look for the Flashpoints channel.
For those who don't know, he's sheriff in Maricopa County, which is Phoenix, Arizona. He was the force behind SB 1070, Proposition 200, which allowed cops to stop people and demand they prove their citizenship. And, it turns out that they were stopping brown people to ask their citizenship. I went to his prison with a foreign national, but very white, Ms. Badpenny, my chief investigator. They never asked. It had a big sign, no illegal aliens, no aliens, right? And they didn't ask her for her identity, and she's not a U.S. citizen. But she did bring her white skin, so that was enough of an ID card. When I say this is important because we actually have to know, again, it connects back to the money. This is not just some Arpaio. Is not just some racist redneck. He is funded through something called Donors Trust. And he has been provided a lawyer named Chris Kobach, the Secretary of State of Kansas, who has been running a campaign to eliminate so-called alien voters. They can't find any. In Florida, they moved to knock out 181,000 voters, almost all of the Hispanic names, but they found and convicted only one single alien who tried to vote in the U.S. election. That was a Republican from Austria. And so when you mention racists like Arpaio, and I don't use it, I don't throw around terms like racist very often, but he's a certified.
He has earned the title. Yes.
Yeah, he's actually been cited by the Justice Department for his racial abuse of office. So he is an officially tagged racist. But the important thing is that this fund, which provided him this lawyer, from this hotshot lawyer who's now Secretary of State of Kansas, is funded by the brothers Koch. And so now we begin to close the circle. That is the firepower to knock out voters is being provided by Koch and other interests. Why the Kochs? I know some of the Kochs, they're not racist, but they see that if you knock out voters of color, poor voters, then they can take the White House and keep Congress and turn those into profit centers. They're not partisan. They're not racist. They use partisan politics, and they cynically use racism to make a buck. And that's what's going on here. So when you mention our pal and Trump, behind it, there's still that screen of the Kochs. I mean, when you have the clown, behind the clown, there's a whole operation.
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're delighted to be speaking with Greg Palast, a very important reporter in this country and abroad. He is, he's a best-selling author of Billionaires and Ballot Bandits. He is the author of Vulture's Picnic, and he really needs to be marked in history as the one some people would like to mark him in and write him off and do terrible things to him. But Greg is the journalist who nailed down the fact that the 2000 election was clearly stolen. And Greg, you sort of opened up that whole door of sort of electronic voter fraud and the sort of Jim Crow goes electronic. Are you concerned this year again in terms of the electronic machines? Should we be worrying about that?
Yes, it's worse than ever, but my main concern is aimed at knocking off voter registrations or actually disqualifying ballots. You know, about 40, we're going to look at about 1 out of 3 ballots in America will be mailed in. You know, it's 10 p.m. Do you know where your ballot is? People worried about electronic machines. Well, when you mail it in, you're mailing it to guys who don't want you to vote. They know your name's on the envelope, by the way. It's not like it's a secret ballot anymore. And I'm very concerned. Back in 2000, I discovered how Catherine Harris used in Florida, and Jeb Bush, by the way, who's personally involved, in knocking off black voters by tagging them as felons, people who are convicted felons who have no right to vote. That's, by the way, only in Florida, not in California. I don't want to warn people listening to this. If you have a record, you can vote in most states, but not in Florida. And it turned out that the only crime these people, these 56,000 black men, were guilty of was voting while black. There wasn't not one Dennis who was actually an illegal voter, not a single one, but they were overwhelmingly black. The United States presidency was decided by 537 votes, excluding those thousands of black male votes. Now, this year we have something new called interstate cross-check. Now, I mentioned Joe Arpaio, the racist sheriff, and his lawyer named Chris Kobach. Chris Kobach is now the Secretary of State of Kansas, but he's also the most influential Secretary of State among the Republican in the Republican Party nationally. He has created a system which he runs out of the state of Kansas for 29 investigation originally for the late lamented Al Jazeera America. And it was not picked up by, you know, the U.S. mainstream at all. But what we found is, and I'm looking at some of this material now, which was hidden, and I uncovered it. You know, if you know Greg Palast's team, we get those documents marked confidential. And what we found was lists of 7 million Americans who are tagged as illegal voters because they voted twice. Now, voting twice, you go to jail for 5 years. Who votes twice? That is, voting once in one state and again in another state. And it's interesting. It's a crime. You have people's addresses and ID numbers and social security numbers, everything. Yet they've basically been able to find no one who does this, but they are threatening to remove the votes of 7 million people. They've already started with Virginia removing 41,000. And guess what, Dennis? Almost all, the overwhelming number of people on this list are voters of color.
Of course.
How do they pull that off? And I'll tell you how they pulled it off, how Chris Kobach, Secretary of State of Kansas, pulled it off. And again, this is with, you know, the guy backed by Koch money, the guy who's defending Arpaio's racist tactics in Arizona, et cetera. How does Kobach pull it off? And the answer is, they say you voted twice if someone with your first and last name has voted in another state. Now, that may sound ridiculous, but it's more than ridiculous. It's a horrific frontal attack on voting, and no one is raising the alarm. So, for example, I'll give you one you'll like.
Well, you can check that out on Flashpoints. Sorry to do that to you, but that's Greg Palast, interviewed by Dennis Bernstein on Flashpoints. You can find it on SoundCloud in its entirety. He goes on to talk about Mohammed being a very common name and how they're using cross-check to get rid of voters. People are still arguing about how Nader ruined the election in Florida when all these votes were stolen from with this felon disqualification fraudulent list. It's a pretty mad world, and nobody knows about cross-check, too. There's some bipartisan support for it, which is pretty idiotic. All right, it's time for me to go. Opinions are those of the speakers. Clarifying something, I guess there was some scheduling double booking of next Monday, but...